Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 10, Voices and Votes. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. Today's episode tackles a tough subject, one that we visit frequently in the Freedom Writer world because it played such a pivotal role in Room 203. That topic is overcoming intolerance and prejudice. We'll be taking an honest look at the tragedy of discrimination and discussing how we can make a more equitable and accepting society. We hope by the end of this episode, you feel more informed and prepared to use your voice to create change. First, you'll hear a story from freedom writer Calvin Williams III. He talks about experiencing racism firsthand as a young man and how he learned to speak out against prejudice. Next, we'll have our diary of the day, an excerpt from the Freedom Writer's Diary about one student's realization that every person has the power to stand up and speak out against injustice. Finally, we have our featured discussion with our guest, David Goodman, an ardent advocate for change. David tells us the heartbreaking story of his brother's tragic murder by members of the Ku Klux Klan and the 44-day federal investigation that followed. He then talks about confronting the horror of racism in America's past, using one's voice to vote in our present, and the crucial role that the youth play in bettering our democracy for the future. I think you'll find David's story harrowing and humbling. As you listen, I invite you to think about how you can use your voice and your vote. Thank you for joining us, and now here's Calvin.
My grandfather was always a man of very few words, and he always taught me that you're always going to be black no matter what. So be the best that you can be. He always talked about when he was in the Navy, and you know, he said, I was in the Navy in the 50s and the 60s. I did 20 years. And he said, you know, my white crew chiefs would treat me different. He said, you know, they treat me bad. And, you know, there's some times where I wanted to go off the hand and, you know, do some things that I shouldn't have done. But you know what? He said, I had a family at home. I had to take care of my family. So I knew I was a black person. I knew they were going to treat me the way they were going to treat me. So I just did what I had to do. I spent 20 years in the Navy. I love what I was doing, and that's all that mattered. My grandfather always told me, keep rolling. To me, at 16 years old, I didn't see white or black. You know, I didn't listen to any of the CNN, the Fox News, or that stuff because it didn't pertain to me. I didn't care. I'm growing up in Long Beach, and Long Beach is a rough city to grow up in. But, you know, like I always say, children do not understand colors. They don't see it. They just see people. So you just see people, but when you see people treat you different for who you are, you're brokenhearted, then it becomes rage, it becomes anger because you do not understand what's happening. As a kid, you don't realize that it's unfair. You just see, like, you're hurt because you don't know why you can't be with those people, because all you see is you see your friends, your classmates. You don't see colors, you don't see religion, you just see your friends. I can remember being in my car with my brother and two friends, and a cop just got behind us. I was 16 years old, so I'm a junior in high school, and I knew that the cop was following us. They had no reason to follow us. And it was a beat up car. It wasn't a car that he should even stop this for. You would think maybe a Mercedes or a BMW. It was like a beat up Acura. But we were actually on our way to church. We were in a white neighborhood because my uncle was going to actually speak at that church. So we went to that church, and for some reason, you just saw four black guys in a car, and he wanted to stop us, wondering where we were going. And he handcuffs us. He ran the place, they were clean. But when we were actually handcuffed, we're sitting on the curb, and you see people walking by saying, hey, you know what? Good job, officer, you got him. But he didn't get anything. He pulled us over for no reason. You know, he was looking to see if he can find something on us, and he found nothing. And then he found out we were going to the church, and he was like, well, okay. But, you know, I just wanted to make sure, like, make sure what? You know, there could have been a car where someone has someone in the trunk, or, you know, you could have stopped so many other people, but you chose to stop us because of who we are. That's the type of stuff, the prejudice, that right there, that's the one thing I cannot stand. It's just like, I don't know you. I'm just minding my own business. And someone that's supposed to protect and someone that I believe in is hurting me or treating me different than he would treat anyone else. You know, it's like a parent that beats a child and praises a child. You know, that one child is going to resent them while the other child is going to love them. But at the same time, that child that you're praising may not grow up the way they need to grow up, while that one that resents you will do whatever it takes to get away from you. As of today, when I think about how the world looks, you see all the protests of Black Lives Matter. And a lot of people say Blue Lives Matter. All lives truly matter. We know this. But the thing is, you see Black people dead on TV all the time. You don't see cops all over TV. You don't see white people over TV. And that's the one thing we're saying, is that I'm tired of seeing me on TV. I'm tired of hearing reports of me dying, you know? I'm always gonna be who I am no matter what. And I make sure that anyone that comes behind me knows they can be whoever they want no matter who they are. I still believe in police. I just want the violence to stop. And one of the things I wanna see is that we as a American people, we just stand our ground against those who want to discriminate against anyone and make this country a better place, to make this world a better place. We can do this. I know we can.
I'm so proud of Calvin and all of my students who, in the face of rejection and discrimination, chose to challenge convention by using words instead of weapons. In that sentiment, Freedom Riders came together as a family and started a journey to change the world for the better. And that journey continues to this day. That powerful choice to use their voices and take action is featured in today's Diary of the Day, Diary number 74. This excerpt comes from our book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, and it will be read by Freedom Writer Ty Leggings.
Dear Diary, my mom always told me that one person can make a difference that can change the whole world. It sounds unbelievable that one person can be a catalyst for such a change. She also told me that when she was young, during the 60s, there were many men and women that made significant changes that affected her life, as well as the world around her. Rosa Parks was one of those incredible people that changed the world. Even though she was a law-abiding citizen, she felt so strongly that she should be able to sit in the white section of the bus. She refused to move from her seat and was then arrested. Her bold action astonished many people. They believed that if this small, lone African-American woman could take such a courageous stand, that they could too. Many people believed that she had done nothing wrong, so they started to boycott the buses. No one rode the buses for weeks. Rosa Parks opened the door for one of the most famous boycotts of our time and introduced the struggle for civil rights. I can see from this one person's actions that my mother was right. After listening to my mom's account of Rosa Parks' protest, I thought about the power she had, the power to challenge segregation and to stand up for what she believed was right. Rosa Parks was a true catalyst for change, and she was only one person. Hearing about Rosa Parks and her protest showed me that there is hope for me and all the students in Ms. G's classes to truly be catalysts for change. Imagine, if there were 150 Rosa Parks standing up for tolerance, what a difference we could make.
The Freedom Riders are living proof that a small group of determined individuals can indeed make all the difference in the world. Every year, Freedom Riders and the Freedom Rider teachers speak to kids around the globe, inspiring them to use their talents to transform themselves. If you want to learn more about the Freedom Riders Foundation, visit us online at freedomridersfoundation.org. It's time for our featured discussion, recorded in New York City. Here it is, my conversation with David Goodman. It is an honor for me to introduce our guest today. He has taken the pain of the past and made it his passion and his purpose to make the world a better place. And so I'd like to introduce to our listeners my friend, activist, and fighter of the good fight, David Goodman.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. It's mutual.
So David, the company you keep and the friends that you run with are filling the pages of history books. We write about them, we see movies about them, and yourself and your family. So I want to start before you were an icon. You were this ordinary kid, blessed to be in an extraordinary family. Tell me about your family and your heritage.
Well, my great-grandfather's name was Wolf Goodman, and he immigrated to the United States, like so many people, with no money in his pocket. Typical story. From Lithuania. He and his wife were Jewish, so we're a Jewish family. And at the time, which was just before the Civil War, if you were Jewish in Lithuania, from time to time, the Tsar's police would come into a Jewish community or town, take 20 families out of their house into the public square and slit their throats and set them on fire, just for fun. And when I learned about this, I was well out of high school. And I never understood that kind of violence. I mean, I just couldn't relate to it. Intellectually, I tried to put some meaning around why would someone murder someone they don't even know over some kind of a value or difference of values. But those attitudes have been handed down over centuries from father to son, grandfather to grandchild. So things have changed and haven't changed.
I want to go back to that Freedom Summer where it's Mississippi, it's 1964, and your brother was living in New York with you. How would you describe your brother, Andy, and what made him want to leave New York and go to Mississippi?
Well, you know, I would use the word idealist, who believed that all people were created equal. A simple ideal, which is the foundation of our ideals in America. Although different people interpret them differently. And Andy was very interested in this word fairness. He was the middle of three siblings, males, and I would fight with my older brother, even though he was 6 years older than me. Andy Goodman was the middle brother, 3 years. And Andy was always trying to mediate the fights and did the same thing in school. He was a strong kid, much stronger than me. If the bully was in school, he'd go up to him, even if the bully was bigger than him. Actually, I remember one case where a bully who was in his class but bigger than him was pushing around someone 2 years in a lower class, and my brother said, "Why don't you push me around?" He was big on fairness, this idea, and things should be fair. And so I asked him, "Why are you going to Mississippi?" I was 17, my brother was 20. When he said he was going to go, it was April of 64, I was about to graduate from high school in May, a month later. The United States of America at that time was totally segregated everywhere. And he said, well, he heard that Negroes, that was the politically correct word at the time, couldn't vote in Mississippi, even if they wanted to. And he said, that's just unfair. That was it. He worked for SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which recruited young students, predominantly white, who worked under the direction of the black leadership in Mississippi. And the head of SNCC was John Lewis, who was 24 years old. So the black leadership had this idea. They were going to organize a drive to bring about 1,000 white students from the North to Mississippi to help register people to vote. Now, the strategy was, once these white people were engaged, rest of America would get the news. If you got white people involved and they got beat up or had their heads split open or could just demonstrate, their parents would pay attention and call their politicians, their elected representatives. Keep in mind that the Montgomery bus boycott happened 10 years before Freedom Summer. In between, there were all kinds of demonstrations, almost always run and staffed, if you will, by black people in the Deep South, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Think of this summer as kind of the peak of the civil rights movement. They've been at it basically 10 years, and there was no national recognition of the murders and lynchings of black people, just like the Jews were lynched in Tsarist Russia. I did make that connection as a personal matter. But I didn't have a sense that Andy was doing anything dangerous. It didn't occur to me. He was only in Mississippi for 24 hours. He and two co-civil rights workers, James Cheney and Michael Schwerner, they were kidnapped by the Ku Klux Klan and murdered on June 21st, 1964. This was the first and the last time in the history of the United States where blacks and whites were lynched in the same moment, Christians and Jews, in one instance. And when that happened, it shook the cultural DNA of white America, because if a black lives were taken, well, that didn't really matter to most white Americans at the time. That's my opinion. Certainly, it didn't matter to the Ku Klux Klan, who murdered my brother. Later on, in a court proceeding, one of the murderers said, "We got an N-word and two Jews." Mm. And that, to him, was the highest honor they could get. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't understand the divisions and the nature of our country. I just was naive, like most of my friends and most Americans. Didn't pay attention. I didn't understand what racism was, because I'd never been confronted with it. I learned pretty quickly, though. And since then, which was 54 years ago, it caused me to pay attention to what goes on in our country and read in between the lines, as they say, everything.
I want to ask you a question. You know, we have listeners around the globe, and I'd love for you to describe what the Ku Klux Klan is and the inhumanity of the actions they actually take.
The simple answer is I would make an analogy to the Ku Klux Klan was to America what the extreme terrorists are, ISIS and folks like that, but they're American-born terrorists. They weren't the majority of the population, but they were big enough to terrorize anybody who disagreed with white supremacy and wanted to allow black people to vote, because in Mississippi, black people weren't allowed to register to vote. So the mainstream white American, not just in the South, believed black people were inferior, and this was a kind of Hitler-esque type view of the supremacy of white people, and that America is for white people, and that everybody else is secondary. The Ku Klux Klan enforced those attitudes with violence, murders, lynchings, killings. These were white Protestant Americans. In fact, the leader of the 18 men who killed my brother, identified by the FBI and in court proceedings, was a Baptist minister. And the other two were policemen. The two pillars of kind of stability in society is religion and law and order. And those were who murdered my brother and Schroeder and Cheney and thousands of others. To this day, when the Black Lives Matter soundbite came out, a lot of white people said, "Well, don't white lives matter too?" And it was so difficult to explain to people, look it, my brother was murdered by terrorists, American-born terrorists. To them, black lives didn't matter, obviously. If black lives had mattered, my white brother would still be alive today. So I understand that white lives don't matter until black lives matter.
Mm. When you think about that very first day, do you think that the KKK was tipped off that Schwerner, your brother Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney were going to go out and register voters? Was it accidental or was it targeted? How and when and why did it happen on that very first day?
Good question. So if you don't know the geography of Mississippi, think of it as a box. And if you're looking at a map, the left side of the box is the Mississippi River, where the cotton has traditionally been grown. And the right side of the box is the border with Alabama, where no cotton was grown. And there was less slavery, and it was predominantly white. It was the most racist part of Mississippi. Meridian and Neshoba County were ground zero of hardcore, violent, racist, American terrorists. And my brother was appointed to Meridian, Mississippi. So Mickey Schwerner, from New York City, had his office in Meridian, which was a 30 or 40 minute drive away from Philadelphia, Mississippi. Their objective was to set up something called Freedom Schools. And they would hold sessions around how to go to the courthouse and register to vote. And they also taught black history. That was unheard of in Mississippi. It was all white history, even taught to blacks, even though the schools were segregated. Anyway, they would go to churches, black churches, and see if they would sign up to be a freedom school. And there was one in Philadelphia that signed up called the Mount Zion Methodist Church. And the Ku Klux Klan has spies all over. And there was something called the White Citizens Council, which was funded by the Mississippi State Legislature that spied on people who wanted to integrate society at the time. They told the Ku Klux Klan this is happening. In the meantime, Schwerner and Cheney went to Ohio to meet the 1,000 trainees who were going to come to Mississippi. My brother was one of them. The Ku Klux Klan burnt down the church. Put this in context. That summer, the KKK burnt down, white Christians burnt down 37 Christian black churches that were registering or holding freedom schools. Christians burning Christian churches. I mean, it's insane. You couldn't write this stuff. You couldn't make it up. The reason they burnt down that church, which was one of the first, was to see if Schwerner would come back to investigate it, and they were going to nab him. And that's exactly what he did. They were in Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, where the training center was. And it was burnt down June 15th or 16th. And Schwerner heard about it, and he and Cheney asked for a volunteer out of the 1,000 kids to go and investigate this burning of a church in Mississippi. So the kids, the volunteers, flipped the coin, and my brother won the coin flip.
So when I think about 44 days went by before they discovered the body. So what does that feel like? It's 44 days of summer, and the entire world was watching.
Yeah. When you say world, it's kind of interesting. I didn't appreciate until much later it was the international story. It was global. A day after my brother went missing, this story went viral, not just in New York, not just in the United States, globally. And there were police cars lining the block every day, all day long, between 100 and 200 reporters in front of our house. They were constantly coming upstairs and interviewing my mother. So you have to understand a little about my mother. Deep down, she was an organizer and a street smart, brass knuckles fighter. She dressed professionally with pearls on. And
ironically, I'm wearing my pearls.
And she was extremely well-spoken, which was in the 40s and 50s, for a female to have that stature was almost unheard of. And she understood how to present to the public, because she was constantly in front of the New York State Legislature lobbying. Her profession was health and wellness. She was a mental health professional, and she was the director of one of the largest psychiatric hospitals in the state. And she understood how to reach and touch the public. And that's how she approached the public with this message. We should not fight with each other. We should come together, and this should not happen. Our children shouldn't be murdered. Our society should not be divided. It's almost a message for today.
It was so compassionate, and there was so much empathy. And I think any mother would identify with your mother.
Yes.
And I think that's what really galvanized people.
She was consistent, didn't get too complicated, and made it clear that you can't go around murdering someone because of their opinion. Of course, that's not what the Ku Klux Klan thought, and that's not what the majority of self-proclaimed racists would think. You know, you get in my way, I'll shoot you.
Did you ever envision, like, did you think maybe they've kidnapped him? Or what was, as a 17-year-old, this is going on for those 44 days, what did you think? Were you holding out hope?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the FBI, I have a tape that I heard many, many years later of Hoover, 24 hours after they were missing. And he apparently just found the car they were in, which is set on fire and burning. And he said, "Mr. President, we found the car." And the president said, "Well, was there anyone in it?" He said, "We don't know. It's too hot to open the doors." And he said, what do you think happened? He said, "Well, it doesn't appear that they're in the car." Then the president said, "Well, maybe they've been kidnapped and they're holding them someplace." And this is what Hoover said. He said, "Those people aren't that generous. They've probably been killed." This was 24 hours. So that was day one of 44 days. We didn't know that. We didn't know that. Between June 21st, 1964, and August 4th, everybody in Mississippi, everybody who was black, knew they were dead. And the white people who were close to the issues knew they were dead. Subsequently found out they threw them in a dam that was under construction and buried them about 15 feet under the ground. And the FBI got a crane, a drag line, and removed the dam and found them. This was on August 4th, about the late afternoon. The director called Johnson and told him, and Johnson told his chief of staff, his name was Lee White, to call the families before this was announced. And Lee White called up my house, and my mother and father were at a concert at Lincoln Center. I called my godfather and he went and got him. But that's how we found out. The White House called us. We couldn't believe it. We couldn't accept that. So it was tough. We got so much mail. A mailman brought a Santa Claus bag of mail every day. I mean, we had a huge apartment. We had 20 people sorting through it. And there were two piles, a very, very big pile, actually a dining room table, and a little pile. And the little pile was the hate mail. Your son stuck his nose into other people's business. Don't be surprised that it got cut off. You deserve it, you J bastard, etc. And that was a very small pile. I still have those, written by hand. Wow. And almost never signed. But the bulk of the letters were so sorry, this is horrible, this isn't the America that I believe in, from Mississippi, from all over the South, all over the United States. So it was a shock to me because I didn't know any of this kind of sentiment existed. I was a kid.
But you were a kid in the most loving environment. I mean, you were a family of love and leadership and light. So to have this light have a dark cloud must have changed all of you. What I want our listeners to know is this excruciatingly, indescribably painful thing happened to you and your family, but you became activist and you did something. And the legacy that you have created and your life's mission to this day is about trying to make the world just and noble and fair. So talk about this legacy that you have created in honor of your brother, in honor of those 44 days, in honor of that injustice. How do you and your family make the world more fair?
Well, thank you. You're kind. So that's really a good question because it runs to the heart of who America is. And it's not me. I'm not doing anything that's, you know, particularly brave or unusual. It's in our collective self-interest. So here's kind of a hidden unknown that a lot of people may not realize. So my brother's murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. There are 20 men identified by the FBI who were involved in this posse of terrorists who murdered him. They indicted in a federal court. See, murder in the United States can only be tried in a state court. But the state of Mississippi wouldn't try. They never did. The United States of America, the government, took up a law that was passed just after the Civil War that policemen cannot kill or conspire to kill anybody. It's violation of their civil rights. So they took a civil rights statute and tried them on that in a federal court and convicted 7 of the 20 indicted individuals. The rest went scot-free. None of the people at the scene of the crime, for the rest of their natural lives, the murderers who were known were never, ever tried. Now, this is America where we talk about law and order. There's no law and order when the law doesn't want order.
This is what I love about you, the fact that you were not going to stand idly by, and it was your crusade to bring this to justice. You and your cousin Ed Lowenthal were able to bring about a trial and a conviction. And justice was served.
Ed is my mother's sister's son. So we're first cousins. He was Andy's first cousin. He's a lawyer. And we were asked in 2004, 40 years later, to help the Attorney General of the state of Mississippi. There was a fellow in Jackson, Mississippi, a journalist by the name of Jerry Mitchell, who exposed this case. And he was a forensic journalist and a prize-winning forensic journalist. One of the great journalists in America. Got a MacArthur Genius Grant, by the way, and many other awards. So embarrassed, the state of Mississippi, 40 years later, that they decided, the big mouth of all of them, who wasn't even present at the scene of the crime, they were going to try him. So they needed the families to support that. That's generally custom and practice in the criminal investigation world. So we did, and the Attorney General, his name is Jim Hood, he's still Attorney General of Mississippi, and he got a conviction, not for murder. He wanted to get a murder conviction, manslaughter, which is accidental murder. The only person who wasn't physically there, because they had witnesses who proved, they could demonstrate enough to a jury that he organized the killing of my brother. 41 years to the day, June 21st, 2005, he was convicted of manslaughter. And it was very controversial. So here's the interesting thing to me over the years is that in this country, depending on the circumstances, law and order exists for certain types of people, but not other types of people. So between the Civil War and 1964, there were thousands of lynchings, white people lynching black people. Nothing happened. No problem. Black lives don't matter to the white people who murdered them. And that story of Goodman, Schroeder, and Cheney moved the dial from just black people being unimportant to anyone who stood in the way of the power structure that supported racism, segregation, violence, and terrorism. It's a very tough story to tell people. However, I got an education, I didn't volunteer for it, but I got an education that very few white Americans get and had to pay attention to this story of collateral horror on the one hand and collateral beauty on the other. The horror was the murder and mayhem and the inability and unwillingness for the white power structure to treat black people as equals, but the collateral beauty is personified to me by John Lewis, Martin Luther King, Andy Young, Julian Bond, these iconic names who kept standing up even though the white terrorists beat the crap out of them. They couldn't put them down. And it is that population, those leaders, who have uplifted the soul of America.
Every time I see you in action, you surround yourself with what America could and should be. It's colorful, it's vibrant, it's every religion, it's every color, it's every economic level. You're perpetuating the ability to get people to do something, to vote, to register, to use their voice. So talk about that empowerment of, let's do something, let's collectively get those kids to register. Let's get those kids to march outside the White House if need be. You do things. You're not just a speaker, you're a doer.
I come from, on my father's side, four generations of civil engineers who were contractors. My grandfather built the 8th Avenue subway. My father worked on the Lincoln Tunnel. And I, working for a contractor, building the third water tunnel in New York City, which is the largest public works project in the United States, 600 feet under the ground, so on and so forth. I was brought up in a family that viewed their work as serving the public. We lived in New York, the only major city in the world that has the quality water that we have. Not one pump moves that water. Not one mechanical pump. It's all gravity. The point I want to make is these are thought through, professionally designed and built, diligently put together public service programs. But it's in my self-interest. I want clean water. It's in my self-interest that we have a democracy, too. You cannot survive in a dictatorship where the dictator can come along and you've worked for four generations and they decide, I'm going to take your home and everything we've worked for and just arbitrarily take it. You have to have a democracy. So It's in our self-interest to have a democracy that works. And when you have a portion of society that doesn't reap the benefits of that democracy, you don't have a democracy. You have a partial democracy. And if you have only a partial democracy, it can get eroded more and more and more, and all of a sudden, it's gone.
Mm. So it's water for all. It's democracy for all.
Yes.
And in that same kind of, you're an engineer, so in that engineering mind of being proactive and creating it, you are proactively seeing the problems with our elections and our system and galvanizing the youth. So tell me what it's like to be someone who is a cheerleader for what democracy should be.
So in the Andrew Goodman Foundation, which my mother started in 1966, her vision basically was to take this iconic story about a young volunteer who wanted to make democracy work and encourage other young people to do the same thing. It's really powerful. Our mission literally says, making young voices and votes a powerful force in democracy. Andy Goodman and the 1,000 volunteers were literally students. Young voices and votes.
Young voices and votes.
Votes. Ooh, voices
that's good
and
alliteration.
Votes.
Young voices and votes.
Votes, a powerful force in democracy. Throughout history, not just in our country, it's been people between the ages of 18 to 30 who've made substantive, radical changes. Don't forget, Thomas Jefferson was 33 years old when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. 33.
Wow.
It's a child. I'm 71 now. 33. John Lewis, when he ran SNCC, was 24 years old. That was a revolutionary movement. And it's young people who are almost, I'm not saying this with any meanness, naive about the danger they're facing. I think my brother, you know, young people do dangerous things. They were all doing dangerous things. Some of them knew it, some of them didn't. So it's making young voices and votes a powerful force in democracy. Why? Well, we know, and most people who pay attention know, that the least likely person in the United States of America to vote is a person between 18 and 20, say 29, least likely to vote. So my age, the baby boomers, are about 70, 75% likely to vote. Somebody who are, we call millennials, are 49% likely to vote. So why would a politician pay attention to the voices of young people when you could put your money and try and persuade the older people to vote for you, since they're more likely to vote? So it's in the interest of our democracy, in my opinion, that the young people vote. So that's why we focus on that age group, 18 to 25. And where are they concentrated? In colleges.
You must be so encouraged by what's happening now with the young people in Parkland, Florida, and everywhere else that are able to shut down streets and do school walkouts. For you, this must be the clean water. This must be democracy at its purest and its finest. Does your spirit soar when you see these young people doing these great
things? Oh, absolutely.
Last
week, I'm showing you a picture now of two of the Parkland students that was taken last week in New Jersey. The young lady there, Jacqueline, is on the front page of
Time.
We'll
have to put this in our show notes. I'm holding his phone with two very familiar faces that I've seen on CNN and
right.
Every news channel when I'm flipping through.
That night, Senator Cory Booker, who is a very good friend of my cousins, Ed Lowenthal, and my family friend, gave them an award for their willingness to step up and step out. But we've been working with this age group for decades. And what we do is encourage them to be organized and proactive. Don't think for a second that this age group is apathetic. These kids are not apathetic. There are serious impediments to voting and cultural challenges for any freshman to learn their way around the ropes, and they need to be told where's the voting booth, as silly as that may sound. After all, I've been at it for 50 years, so I know where my voting booth is. What goes on in this country is stunning, but it always has been. One side or the other of the major parties have, this is why we're nonpartisan, absolutely 100% nonpartisan. The men who murdered my brother basically didn't want black people to vote. It was about voting. It was about power. If you control the vote, you control the power. If you control the power, you control the money. Because politics is all about where does the tax money go and policy, right? So black people couldn't vote. They had no rights. They had no economic power. There have always been impediments to voting. That was the Democratic Party back then. Today, it's flip-flop. The people who are passing voting impediment rules are Republicans. So from my point of view, I want to see democracy work. So whether the Republicans impede people from voting or certain people or the Democrats do it, it's both wrong. It's immoral. It's un-American. So we work at approximately 60 colleges. We have 130 paid students who do peer-to-peer organizing. They go out to register these students to vote. There's about 40 million who do vote out of 70 million who can vote because only half of them vote. And we use registering, getting out the vote as an entry point for these young people to look for impediments to voting. It's important to take that 49% to 50% to 51% to 52% to 55%. A percent, by the way, is 200,000 voters. So we don't know how anyone votes, and we don't really care. We just want them to participate. And what do you do? Yes, you can go to our website, andrewgoodman.org, and learn about America. You can look at what we do, and if you're in a college, you can contact us if we're not at your college. But all of this work has to be disciplined and organized. It's not, well, let's get all excited, and you wake up one morning, and you run out, and you do something for a week, and then you go on to the next.
It's back to the water. It's back to that digging that ditch,
right.
Bringing that water.
It takes decades to build a great water system. It takes centuries to build a great democracy. It takes a very short time to tear them down. Think about a house, how long it takes to build a single-family home for existence. You can knock a house down with a bulldozer in about 2 hours, and it takes about a year to build a house. You can knock things down easily, so you constantly have to be maintaining the democracy in order for it to work. And when you leave it alone, it falls apart. And we're in a moment now where it has fallen apart in many ways, and people are beginning to see that and doing something about it. But I saw it when I was 17.
The inverse of 17 and 71. I love that at 71, you're as active, if not more so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was trying to get my clothes in a suitcase to go to college when I was 17, not think about did our democracy work or not.
And now you're changing colleges.
Well, I hope so. I don't think I do anything. I encourage other people to do it. But you can't make somebody do something. They got to want to do it. You can show them a possible path. Not all of them will go on it. But a lot of people don't know where the path is. And they don't know how to stick on it when it gets tough.
I'd like you to give a call to action first and foremost to a student. Because they're ripe for the picking. You are the teenage whisperer. So if you had a call to action specifically for a young person, what would that call to action be?
I'll tell you what we actually do. Every summer before the academic year starts, we get about 100 students together from 25 states, and we train them around telling their story and getting them to articulate what's important to them. That then is a signal to us to help them move forward based on what moves them, not us. And you find out pretty quickly around a consensus of issues that really matter to this age group. And you have to encourage them, not do it for them, to organize around what they care about. We had one lady get up and tell her story, and she said that at the age of 5, she was 22, she was sold by her father into sex trafficking. I mean, it was a stunning experience. And she wants to deal with sex trafficking. And she joined the Andrew Goodman Foundation because she realized this is a public policy issue and you got to get people out to vote who care about it and vote the right way. So to her, in the context of her story, voting became the front door to her policy issue. Another kid gets up and talked about it. His best friend had a kidney problem. He wanted to give one kidney to his friend, and they went through the health system, and he died before the paperwork could be finished. And he thought, this is terrible. What's the matter with our health system that took months to do the paperwork? And he said, I have to get the right politicians elected so that that'll never happen again. So that's why voting is important to me. All of these kids on their own came around to the view that no matter what they cared about, it had to do with public policy and it had to do with electing the right people who would carry out the policy they cared about, making young voices and votes a powerful force in democracy. The millennial generation last year, for the first time, became bigger than the baby boomers. Last year, they can outvote them. The baby boomers are finishing their life now. I was in the first year of the baby boomers, 1946. We're getting old and dying. The millennials are alive and well. They got the country to inherit. Take it over.
So for those adults, how can we encourage them to make sure they don't stand idly by? If they see something, to say something, to stand up and speak out and step up, like you say. I'm talking about just a listener who's driving their car right now or in their kitchen cutting up vegetables and saying, I haven't done anything big and bold yet. But the operative word is yet. What could somebody do in that car, in that kitchen, that makes them feel that they matter?
So we often ask people, what's most important to you? Almost without hesitation or doubt, people say their family. And you talk to a parent, you know what they're going to say. The spouse is not most important. The children are most important. So you think, for example, of a mother and father in Flint, Michigan, who wake up one morning to learn, they already know the water is terrible, that their kids are being poisoned because it's cheaper to pump crap water out of a river than give them good water. I'm a hydraulic engineer. I'm holding up a bottle of clean water. If you care about your child, you need to care about clean water. If you care about clean water, which we should all care about, then we got to elect officials who care about clean water and won't sell it the cheapest possible crap that you can get. If you care about clean air and you want your children to breathe good air and not be on oxygen because they got asthma, my son almost died from asthma. We lived right over a highway. We moved. But what about everybody else who lives in polluted air? If you care about that, all of this is public policy, what we allow, what we don't allow. Obesity, which is a big problem. Why? Because of the junk food that makes so much money, public policy, who you vote in. It all comes down to voting. It's the same story as Mississippi, Freedom Summer in Mississippi. If you don't vote, the politicians ain't gonna listen to you. So if you're driving your car and you're 50 years old and have kids and you care about them, pay attention and vote. Vote for the person who you think will protect your child's interests, because your life is getting on, but theirs is starting.
In honor of their truth, may we all use our voices and our votes to make a difference. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Cyrier, with production assistance from Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please share it with your students, your colleagues, your friends, and family. And if you feel inspired, please leave us a review. It helps the podcast grow so we continue to have that message of hope and freedom for everyone who listens. Our call to action today is this. May we step up and step out. May we uplift the soul of our communities. And as our guest David Goodman personifies, may we all be a powerful force in democracy. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told. We want to thank each of you for supporting the Freedom Writers podcast. We're so grateful for your feedback on the show so far, and we're thrilled with your powerful reactions to our guests' incredible stories. Thank you so much for listening every week, for sharing it with others, and for helping the podcast grow. Remember, we're here for you, and we look forward to bringing you more content to help you make a difference. Summer is now upon us, and for those of us here at the Freedom Writers Foundation, that means institute season. Every year, we host several teacher training institutes where we bring educators from around the globe right here to Long Beach for an intensive teacher workshop. Since we truly put our hearts and souls into these institutes, during the busy summer season, our new podcast episodes will be coming to you every other week instead of every single week. There's one more episode we'll be releasing next week, and then we'll be switching to a bi-weekly schedule for the rest of the summer. Please continue to stay tuned to the Freedom Writers Podcast for more voices and more stories. We are here to humbly serve you.